What we're going to talk about today, and I welcome you to my session. I'm glad you decided to choose my class. We have 12 choices or something like that. So anyway, we're going to talk about what might seem to be a technical question, but it's not really, it's to some extent it's technical, but it's also practical. That is how we relate the Old Testament and the New Testament when it comes to morality, the moral teachings of the Old Testament and the New, and how they're connected with each other. So that's the topic. And the reason I picked that topic is because I'm an ethics professor. So that's what I'm interested in, is the moral dimension of things. And if you wanted technical treatment of Hebrew and Greek verbs, you've probably picked the wrong session. But if you want to know how we think about relating the Old Testament and the New Testament in terms of morality, then you're in the right place. So that's what we're going to do. Let me open us in prayer. Lord, I do pray that you'll give us all energy for this latter part of this conference today, and that you'll help us to wrap our minds around this question, to read the Bible rightly, to know your will, to live it out. Help us to avoid errors on all sides and to get this right. And then teach others as well. It is a great responsibility to be one of your followers, Lord. And it is a especially great responsibility to be a teacher of others. And so I pray that you'll guide me and guide all of us who serve as your followers and also as teachers. In Jesus' name. Okay. Let me start off with a bias statement that that may help you understand where I'm coming from on this topic. And the bias statement is, I'm biased towards ethics, which means I'm biased towards Christians being serious about living moral lives. Okay? So if that's a bad bias, then just walk out on me now. Just leave. I really think that Christians are called to be morally thoughtful, serious people. Doesn't mean we don't have any fun. It just means that we take the moral dimension of our faith seriously. That the Christian faith is about not just what we believe, but how we live in every dimension of our lives. And so that bias then connects to an observation. The observation is that many Christians are not terribly morally serious. And many American Christians, I think, including actually conservative Christians, are not don't give evidence of taking the moral dimension of the faith very seriously. Or there's a great deal of selectivity. We're serious about a couple of things, but not real serious about the whole package. And so if that's true, I study this and teach it, and I do think that's true. It's not, of course, everybody, but there's a moral weakness in our people. One reason why we're blending into an increasingly decadent culture, we're blending in all too well. And so then the question would be, well, why is that? What's going wrong? Besides just the sin nature, which makes us vulnerable to messing up. Why is that? And I think that it is possible to identify a variety of reasons, but I think there's a structural issue in how we understand the moral dimension of the Bible. And that structural issue, I think, is kind of signaled by a couple of dichotomies. It goes something like this. Law versus grace. You might say, another one related to that, law versus gospel. Works versus faith. Close to this, legalism versus freedom. Probably enough. I think they all point to a reality that I think is there. I think that many Christians have misinterpreted the New Testament to mean we no longer have specific moral obligations because we're Christians. We are free. And we are under grace, which means we no longer have specific moral obligations as Christians. And another dichotomy that I would put in here at the very top is something like this. Old Testament versus New Testament. The Old Testament was a book of laws, a book of commands, we think, for people who thought that law would win them salvation and who became legalistic. Instead, the New Testament is a book about grace for people who respond to the gospel in faith and who are now free to live, well, however they feel led to live. Okay. That's a caricature, but I think there's a lot to it. And I want to say a couple of things. One is, this was never an adequate summary of what is in the Old Testament. Okay? And this is not an adequate understanding of what is in the New Testament. That there is more continuity than discontinuity between the Old and the New Testament. The whole theme of this conference is the unity of the Bible. And one key element in that unity is going to have to be continuity between the testaments, between the Old and the New Testament. There is some discontinuity, and I'm going to talk about that today. But if all you can, if you cannot see the continuity, then what tends to happen is that the Old Testament drops out. Christians stop reading it, stop taking it seriously, and are not informed by it for the living of their lives. And I think that that leads to negative consequences. So look at the handout and we'll try out what I mean. Defining the challenge. The Bible contains thousands of moral laws, exhortations, principles, proverbs, observations, and stories with lessons, you might say. How do we bring this vast body of material together into a coherent synthesis? That's the broad question, and that's kind of what this whole conference is about. But in particular, how do we relate the moral materials of the Old Testament with those of the New Testament? Well, one of the first things I want to do to answer that question and to provide a model is to say that the Old Testament is more than law. Okay. I want to suggest that if you wanted to do an analysis of genres rather than just saying the Old Testament equals law, that there are at least four main types of genres in the Old Testament. Okay? If you look at the left column down the page, those genres are narratives, laws and practices I'm going to treat together, the wisdom and poetry literature, and the prophets. Okay? And I want to talk about each of those. But if you break down the material that way, then you discover that the New Testament has the same genres. Okay? Narratives, laws and practices, laws, commands, moral teaching, wisdom teachings, and prophetic type materials. This is new. More people see that in relation to the Old Testament than they do in the New, but I think I can show that there's all four types of material in both Testaments. So one point of continuity is the genre continuity. All of these ways of communicating truth are found in both Old and New Testament. And so when you compare them, you discover more continuity than we have been typically led to see. But there is appropriate discontinuity that we'll also talk about. Okay, so let's talk about narratives to start off just a minute. A narrative is a story. Okay? And one of the first things that I want us to see is that the Bible is a story first. Old and New Testament, the Bible is a story and a collection of stories. Okay? And that applies as equally to the Old Testament as it does to the New. So to reduce the Old Testament to a law book is to miss the narrative framework in which the laws are given. You see what I'm saying? The Bible doesn't begin with, thou shalt not. It begins with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's a story. Okay? Begins with a story. The way this is commonly broken down, the way I often do it in class, is to say that there is a grand biblical story and there are particular biblical stories. You can talk about it in that way. So, the grand biblical story, as has been discussed in the conference, is the story of creation, fall, and redemption. Right? God creates the world. It's a good world. Human beings sin and mess it up. God judges. But God acts to redeem humanity by making covenants. Okay, so the covenant paradigm. And then, and that's where we live. We live in the time of covenant. Covenant with the church. And in the future, Jesus Christ will return and bring history to an end. And you might say that all that was wrong will be set right. Okay? So this fourfold paradigm would be creation, fall, redemption, consummation. And that creation, fall, redemption, consummation, or eschatology paradigm runs through the entire Bible. And we're supposed to read our lives as falling within that paradigm. I am created in God's image. I am a sinner. God has been gracious to me in Christ. I am being redeemed. And in the end, I will experience resurrection and eternal life. Okay? But that's also the story of the planet, not just of me, in a sense, the broad paradigm. Okay. So, a point of continuity. All of that is there, Old and New Testament together. Another point of continuity, the Bible is full of specific stories. Okay? And those stories have moral content, whether that moral content is drawn out explicitly or not. And so, one of the things I think we need to get better at is seeing the way that the Bible's stories teach us moral truths. We do this to some extent. What do we teach children? Right? We don't teach them 10 principles or 12 steps or whatever. We teach them stories. And then they draw the lessons from the stories. And the little secret is that adults learn better that way too. That's why if a preacher just gives you 8 theological propositions and no illustrations, you probably don't remember the theological proposition. We are story-formed people. We live by stories. We remember stories. We remember them a whole lot better than principles and propositions. I want to say specifically in terms of the content of the Old Testament that I have become persuaded in my years as an ethicist. It's a great title. You don't know too many ethicists probably, you know? What do you want to be when you grow up? Well, I want to be a fireman. What about you? I want to be an ethicist. Anyway. That the most important Old Testament story is the first story, Genesis 1 through 3, especially. And one of the things I've been saying today to the groups is become as well-versed as possible in Genesis 1 through 11, especially. What's called the primeval history, creation, fall, the flood, the covenant with Noah, the Cain and Abel story, the Tower of Babel. These primeval stories, in ethics, I find myself coming back to them again and again. For example, what shall we teach about marriage? Where do you start? Genesis 1 and 2. What shall we teach about sexuality? Where do you start? Genesis 1 and 2. What shall we teach about God's creation and how we're supposed to take care of it? Genesis 1 and 2. And 3, actually. How do we teach about the nature of sin and temptation? Genesis 3. What about a theology of work? Why we work, what it means, and why it's so hard, but also why it's important for us? Genesis 1 through 3. We often argue about Genesis 1 and 2 over things like, was it 6 literal days, and how long ago was it, and all that. As an ethicist, I want to argue over the meaning of those kinds of things. Work, sexuality, marriage, creation, family. And that all goes back to Genesis 1 through 3. And even the theme of covenant is introduced in Genesis 1 through 11 with Noah. What about vegetarianism and what we should eat? Also, Genesis 1 through 3. Right? So become an expert on Genesis 1 through 3. First contribution, especially that, but I also say Genesis 1 through 11. Then, of course, once you get past that, you get into the narrative of God's relationship with the Jewish people. Christians, in a sense, should be the world's leading experts on God's relationship with the Jewish people, besides the Jewish people themselves. Because we have the story that begins with Abraham and takes you through the whole, all the patriarchs, and everybody should know this. You ought to be able to go into any youth group full of people who are there every week and say, tell the story of what happens in the Old Testament. The broad story, and do it in four sentences. It's really doable, right? God calls the people, beginning with Abraham. That people ends up in bondage in Egypt, and God liberates them in the Exodus. God makes a covenant with them at Sinai. They wander for 40 years, and then they conquer the Promised Land. God sends judges to lead them, and finally they ask for a monarch, and they get one, for better or for worse. The Jewish people split into a northern and southern kingdom, both of which are eventually destroyed by enemies. And then the southern kingdom ends up being, most people end up being shipped off into exile. Some come back into a return and restoration, and that's the end of the Old Testament. Do people know how to do that in your church? Do they have that story in their head, right? A lot of times we get lost. We can't tell the forest from the trees because we can tell you maybe the David and Goliath story, but we can't situate it there in the broader story, you know, or what the lessons might be of that story. So, become people who are fluent in the broad biblical story, the specific stories, and then realize that the story of the New Testament is still a story. The story of the life of one God-man, Jesus Christ, and of the church that he founded. In a sense, that's the New Testament story, and it is also a story. So, to the payoff for this section, what do we do with narratives? We frame our entire worldview according to the biblical narrative. We become fluent in the theological and moral meanings of the broad biblical story and of the specific stories. And like any good story, we learn to understand and take seriously the characters in the story. God is the central character in the story of the Bible. So the more we learn about God, the more stories we tell about God and understand God's character, the better we understand the Bible. But also, we learn about the characters, this great array of characters that we find in the Bible. I mean, you know, all the way, I mean, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Daniel, Esther, Peter, Judas, Paul, you name it. All of these people have a story to tell, and there are lessons to be drawn from their lives. And one of the good things here morally is you can learn from their failures, not just from their successes. It's a good thing that we have stories in the Bible that tell us about fallible people because we are fallible people. So the story part of the Bible, a point of continuity and a rich trove of moral resources. Any questions about that? Place to start? Now, we'll spend most time in this second category, laws and practices. There is no doubt that the Old Testament is full of laws and commands. Okay. And they are located in the part of the Bible we just happen to call the law, right? Torah, in the Pentateuch, especially in Exodus, Leviticus, and then a restatement in Deuteronomy, the sum in Numbers. Okay. It's interesting that we call the first five books of the Bible the law, but if you were actually adding the chapters, probably about half of it is law, maybe, if you think about it, because you've got all the narratives and Numbers, the half of Exodus is narrative, and all of Genesis is narrative. So the law is actually half law. You know what I mean? Right? In Deuteronomy, the way it does law is it's a narrative kind of doing of law in some ways, you know. But anyway, once you get into the laws, I suggest that these definitions are not hard and fast, but I think there are basically four types of laws in the Old Testament. This is not an unfamiliar breakdown, but you may not have seen it before. Ceremonial or cultic laws. That doesn't mean that the Old Testament was a cult. I'm just saying cultic means having to do with worship and ritual. Okay. Ceremonial cultic laws, sacrificial system, what the priests do, the festival calendar, dietary regulations, the high priestly, you know, the priestly families and where they live and such like that, cleanliness rules and regulations, so on. Where do you find most of these kinds of laws in the Old Testament? What book would you think of? Leviticus, right? The book that nobody ever reads, right? Leviticus, okay? You have some of it in the latter part of Exodus, too. And then it's scattered other places. Okay, I'll go through each of these real fast, and then we'll see what we do with each of them. Civil and governmental laws have to do with this fact. Israel became a state, a country, basically. And countries have laws. And every country has to figure out what it's going to do about things like who will govern. So you've got laws about government. How you will defend yourself. So you've got laws about war. How you will feed yourself and distribute income. So you've got laws about economic life and the land and agriculture and things like that. How you will punish crime. So you've got laws about crime and punishment. Things like that. So these civil and governmental laws regulated the life of the people. You know, things about bribery and how the court system is supposed to work and how you take care of the poor and all of that. Every country has laws like this in that sense. Okay. The difference here, of course, is that the New Testament is about a community that did not become a country, the church. And so this is called, I call this at the bottom here, the nature of the polis, meaning the nature of the community. And I'll say more about that later. All right. Moral and social laws tell you what you should do and not do. Okay? This is what is moral, and this is what is immoral. If you think about, what's the first place you look in the Old Testament for a statement of moral laws? Ten Commandments. Right. Okay? What's interesting about the Ten Commandments is it shows you some of the blurriness of these distinctions. The first is what? What's the first of the Ten Commandments? You should have no other gods before me, which is about worship. Right? It's about religion. Because religion and ethics were blended together in Israel. And it also speaks to the fact that Israel was a theocracy, not a pluralistic democracy like our country. And so, if you violated laws related to Sabbath or taking the Lord's name in vain or idolatry, you could get punished by the people, by the community, like getting stoned to death and stuff like that. So that's not terribly pleasant. But it reflected the way that all of these kind of blended together. Okay, the fourth category, and we often don't think that it's there in the Old Testament, but the fourth category is interior or attitudinal, I would also add now, motivational laws or commands. By the way, there are a variety of Hebrew words for laws, commands, statutes, so on. They all speak to obligations imposed by God on people. But on this, I'm talking about commands about what should be going on in your heart, about what you should be thinking, what you should be feeling, and what should motivate you. Okay. It is easy to think that the Old Testament doesn't have any of this, but that's not true. Where do you see it in the Ten Commandments? Covet. Can anybody make a law that would be enforceable related to coveting? They couldn't because it's inside your gut. I don't know if you're coveting. I know what happens if coveting gets out of control, adultery and theft. But no community can enforce the law that requires you to love. No community can enforce the law that requires you not to covet. But yet, some of those things were commanded in the Old Testament as well. Let me have you look at a passage. Exodus 22:21-27. A good snapshot, if you just want to say, hey, I think I'm going to start looking at Old Testament law a little bit more. If you just read Exodus 21 through 23, you would see all of the things I've been talking about are all there in those three chapters. So lead a Bible study of Exodus 21 through 23 and you'd be on it. Exodus 22, 21 through 27. Listen to the various notes that are struck here. You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you do mistreat them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword. And your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a moneylender to him, and you shall not exact interest from him. If ever you take your neighbor's cloak in pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down. For that is his only covering, and it is his cloak for his body. In what else shall he sleep? And if he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. What do you notice about that little section? Of the four kinds of laws that I've talked about, or commands, what do you say? It's interior. Where do you see the interior part of it? Interior motivational. Yeah, and where does that come from? I want to say that I fooled you here because it goes back to the narrative. It goes back to Israel's story as a people. Look at, for example, 21. Command. You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him. That is a command. That is, at least, I would call that a moral social command. Okay? Why? You were sojourners in the land of Egypt. And that's about being enslaved in Egypt. The story motivates the morality. See? And it goes something like this. You suffered, and you remember that, and you don't want to do that to anybody else. I liberated you because I'm your gracious Redeemer. You remember that. If you don't remember that, I will make you pay for not remembering that. Right? So, Israel's laws, one of the most striking things about Israel's law code compared to the other ancient peoples, is it had much more of an emphasis on taking care of the most vulnerable. Justice means siding with powerless and vulnerable and victimized people against the powerful who will exploit them. And the reason that is emphasized is because they knew the taste of victimization in their gut. And they were committed, and God made sure that they were committed to not doing that to somebody else. Or on 27, if you basically make a guy sleep cold, he doesn't have a covering because you took his coat as pledge, if he cries out to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. This is an echo of Exodus 3, in which the Israelites are crying out in their suffering, same word, and God hears and says, I will act to deliver them from their suffering. It's the same word. You cried out, I heard. They cry out, I will also hear, and you will, you know, bear the cost of that. Okay, so what I want to say then to wrap this part up is to say, the Old Testament offers commands as to how you worship and do a religious kind of ritual piece of your community, how you govern yourself, how you think, feel, and act, and what the motives are for your actions. How much of that carries over to the New Testament? This is the question. If you like were to draw a line across the page to the New Testament side, I would say that we have some continuity and some discontinuity. Okay? Continuity, I would say the New Testament does have rules and exhortations related to how you worship. It does. Right? 1 Corinthians 11, 23 and 24 about how you observe the Lord's Supper. 1 Corinthians 14 about how you keep good order in worship. And of course, a lot of 1 Corinthians is about that. Colossians about how you're supposed to sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. But what happens, what does the New Testament say about the sacrificial system and about the priestly system? What happens with that? Jesus fulfilled that. So we have explicit teaching on that in Hebrews, especially. And so the general Christian tradition on this has said that the Old Testament finds fulfillment in this dimension of its law through Jesus functioning as, you might say, high priest and also as sacrifice in that last ultimate sacrifice on the cross. So, and then the temple is no longer needed. The priestly apparatus in that sense is no longer needed. Sacrificial system is no longer needed. But we still do worship. And then you have regulations for worship that are there. Okay? What about civil and governmental laws about the military, the defense, economics, and crime, and things like that? Can that carry over? How would it carry over to the church? You have a handful of sayings like that that we've wrestled with how to interpret for 2,000 years. And that's in fact what my book is about right now. It's about faith and public life, faith and politics. I want to say that the church is a different kind of community than a state. Okay? So, some of the explicit laws of the Old Testament are not directly relevant to the inner life of the church. We don't do taxes. We don't have judges, per se. We don't send people to jail. We don't fight wars as the church. We don't have an economic system that distributes land and things. However, we do have an inner life that is relevant. How we treat people, how we spend our money, how we handle our bodies, how we handle our family life, and so on, is still significant. Okay? So, one way to say it is that the civil and governmental commands of the Old Testament are not relevant in the New Testament. A better way to say it is that we try to take the principles that are there and live them out in the life of the church. And then we try to bear witness to these same principles in our role as citizens in a community. Take an example. The Old Testament has laws related to how you take care of the poor. Can you remember what some of these laws are? How do you take care of the poor in the Old Testament? Everybody should know this. We don't, because we don't talk about the poor enough. When you work your field, what do you do with... You leave some there so they can glean, right? Everybody is given a parcel of land. And at the end of 50 years, they're supposed to get it back, the Jubilee year. The court system is supposed to be rigidly unbiased so that the poor can get justice in the court. And there are all kinds of other provisions related to this. You can at least apply this. In the life of the church, we will care for the poor along the same principle that you have in the Old Testament. We want people to get their needs taken care of. We want to help people find meaningful work. We want to take care of each other. And then, in terms of our public witness, we have an interest in seeing to it that government does what it is supposed to do in the way it is supposed to do it to help people get their financial needs met and to have a shot at educational and economic opportunity and so on. So I think that we have in the Old Testament helpful principles, both for how we live our lives as the church and for what we say to government about what it should do. That's complicated. That's why people like me have to write books about it. But anyway, it is still usable there, I think. The moral and social commands, I think, continue forward, most of them, into the New Testament. But I think there is a shift, especially at the interior and attitudinal level. And this is the way I would describe it. I think that it is clear that the New Testament, more than the Old, emphasizes the motivational level, wouldn't you say? It's not just what we do, but why we do it. And it's not just if you kill somebody, but also if you're angry and hateful towards them and in your heart at them. The way Jesus emphasized, out of the treasure of a man's heart, so he speaks, you know. A good tree bears good fruit. A bad tree bears bad fruit. The New Testament, more than the Old, emphasizes who we are in our core, and therefore what kind of actions follow from that. I think that the New Testament also emphasizes love more clearly than the Old Testament does. Would you agree with that? And one of the things I want you to notice about that, though love your neighbor as yourself and love God with everything you have, those are both Old Testament statements. Jesus put them together. But in several places in the New Testament, love is described as a law. Have you noticed that? A new commandment I give unto you. Love one another as I have loved you. John 13. Okay. Galatians 5, 13 and 14 says all of the law is summed up in this one law. Love your neighbor. James 2, 8 talks about fulfilling the royal law of love. 1 Corinthians 13 and 14, 1 talk about love. In fact, just about every New Testament book emphasizes love. Look at the themes of 1 John, for example. Okay? If we say we love God but do not love our neighbor, how can we say that we love God? You know, all of those themes. For those who juxtapose love versus grace, law versus grace, or law versus love, I would challenge them to say, what about the law of love, as you find it in the New Testament? That's a point of continuity. Love as a law, I think, is interesting. Another theme that you have in the New Testament more than the Old is a theme of freedom. And that is true. There's a reason for this perspective, the kind of dichotomy. Where do you see New Testament teaching that emphasizes that we do have some freedom to decide before God what we feel is right? Where do you find that? That not everything is clear and everybody governed by exactly the same rules. You know? How about Paul's teaching about eating meat sacrificed to idols? And being sensitive to the weaker brother, right? 1 Corinthians. The idea being, I know, he says, that eating meat sacrificed to idols is not an issue for me, but it might be for you. There is a zone of freedom there, liberty, theme in Galatians. However, love is more important than liberty. I will constrain my liberty in order to take care of you. Right, that's a theme in Paul. So, I think there is some discontinuity in an emphasis on freedom. You don't see a whole lot of emphasis on freedom in the Old Testament, in this sense. Freedom from slavery, but not moral freedom. But on the whole, I mainly see continuity. And I think there's a couple test cases I want you to think about with me for just a minute. Let me just ask you specifically. If somebody said to you, what does the Bible teach about the Sabbath? What would you say? Like, do New Testament people have to honor the Sabbath? Observe the Sabbath. What does that mean? Rest. You think we're still supposed to rest on the Sabbath? We need to. About ready for it, right? But I thought we were under grace. So is there anything particular you don't do on the Sabbath because it's the Sabbath? Yeah, what do you think? Okay. See, what that says is for you, the concept of the Sabbath having a set apartness still, it still works. I mean, it's still there for you. My claim would be that most Christians in the last 50 years have entirely lost the concept of the Sabbath. It's gone. And I don't know exactly why it is, other than the fact that America is about making money. And so, do you all ever see the movie Chariots of Fire? Remember that old movie? We're a certain generation. We've seen the movie. We've been around. You had an Olympic runner who wouldn't race on the Sabbath. Like, can you imagine that now? Not a Christian, anyway. Now, a serious Jew might not race on the Sabbath. But serious Christians, we're happy to race on the Sabbath, right? It means something different to us. I believe there's a Jewish baseball player for the New York Mets, Sean Green. Who the issue came up during the playoffs a couple of years ago, because of, was it Yom Kippur or something? Whether he would play on Yom Kippur. Oh, we say, oh, that's just legalism. Maybe we say that. On the other hand, what's the opposite of legalism? The word we would use is antinomianism. There are no laws. As you know, there is some fresh work being done on the Sabbath these days. And if you actually look at the teaching on the Sabbath, which would be a good study to do in the church, there are two different accounts of it in the Ten Commandments, two actual motivational clauses as to why we're supposed to honor the Sabbath. In Exodus, it's because God rested on the seventh day. In Deuteronomy, it's because God set you free from slavery in Egypt. Therefore, you, your family, your household, your children, your servants, and your animals shall not work on the Sabbath. In Exodus, it's more of a imitate God theme. In Deuteronomy, it's more of a justice theme. Don't work yourself or anybody else to death. Take a day off. Don't make, I mean, because what happens with slavery, you know, no days off. You know, they work you whenever they want to work you. The Sabbath became a very important day of assembly and worship, and you were to do no work on the Sabbath. We know that in the interbiblical period, the rabbis became very, very detailed, and the Pharisees, about what the Sabbath regulations meant. You know, there were 39 tasks, according to the Holman Bible Dictionary, there were 39 specific tasks the Jews were not allowed to do on the Sabbath. And then there were extensions, elaborations, interpretations, and then there were kinds of evasions and so on. And Jesus comes on the scene, and did Jesus observe the Sabbath? What do you think? He taught, he went to worship, he healed. Did he say the Sabbath is not relevant anymore? I don't think did he abolish the concept of the Sabbath? No. He said the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. But I don't think he abolished the Sabbath. I think that would be pretty radical to say Jesus abolished the Sabbath. And what the early church did was to move the Sabbath to Sunday, Lord's Day, Resurrection Day, but to still honor it as a time of, generally in the history of the church, worship, rest, and family time. Now it's, if we maybe we'll go to church if we're not out at the lake, right? You know, yeah, and rest, well, you know, got some shopping to do. Basically, I have recovered the concept of the Sabbath as best I can with my schedule so that I try not to do any of my regular work on Sunday. And just to say, hey, it'll be there on Monday. And I'm going to take the Sabbath. Another principle or another issue, tithing. Was tithing abolished in the New Testament? I know people who think so. I had a guy at church who, a different church, who said, tithing, there's no way we're obligated to tithe. We're not under law, we're under grace. Okay? I looked at this again. Do you know when tithing is first mentioned in the Bible? Abraham, that's some serious Bible knowledge on the front row. That's right. Abraham to Melchizedek. First tithing story. I love you people, you're so good. All right, well, the second time was when Jacob made a pledge to God that he would tithe everything if God would protect him. What's significant about those two stories is it's before the law is instituted. Then you have legal provisions related to tithing in Old Testament law. And, you know, tithing was to support the poor, it was to support the temple, it was to support the priests. Did Jesus ever talk about tithing? Can you think of a passage where he talked about tithing? Yes. Who knows what that verse is? Oh, come on. There you go. All right, it's Matthew 23:23. That's how I remember it. 23:23. Look at that for a second. Yeah, nothing like some good Bible knowledge. All right. Matthew 23:23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. This, by the way, this would have been a fun speech to listen to. For you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected, or but have neglected, the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. We think, so this tithing doesn't matter. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. Bingo. Jesus doesn't say here tithing doesn't matter. What he says is that justice and mercy and faithfulness matter more. And our interpretation of the meaning of tithing must be run through the principles that are broader, justice and mercy and faithfulness. One other little principle or practice to think about is the practice of usury. What is usury? Lending money to get interest. What does the Old Testament say about the legitimacy of this tithe? Right. You are not allowed to lend money to your fellow neighbor, Israelite. We just read the passage in Exodus that talked about if you lend money to any of my people, and we already said that you can't exact interest from him, and you have to give him his cloak back at sundown so he has something to cover himself in. Okay? Does Jesus ever talk about lending money? He does. He does in Luke chapter 6, 35, when he says, lend, expecting nothing in return. Luke 6, 35. Lend, expecting nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. All right, what I think I see with all of these is I never see the New Testament abolishing core practices like this. I see the New Testament intensifying sometimes, shifting the focus, reprioritizing, but not abolishing. Okay. Even in the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus talks about prayer, almsgiving, and fasting, does he say, don't pray, don't give alms, and don't fast? He says what? Do it in secret so that you aren't playing to the crowd. Do it so that you're doing it for God's reward, not for anybody else's. Alright, I've lingered there. Let me move on real quickly to these last couple of sections. I think that we need to recover the wisdom literature in the church. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. The wisdom or poetical books, as they're called, are full of moral resources for us. I broke it down into three main categories here. Observations are when like in Proverbs, where the author observes the moral structure of the universe and says, learn from this. And what's interesting about these observations is a lot of times the moral lesson is never explicit. You just open anywhere in the middle part of the book of Proverbs, and they come tumbling out one after the other. Proverbs 12:1. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge. But he who hates reproof is stupid. Okay? Where's the should in that sentence? Are you told anything in particular that you have to do here? It's implicit. It's an observation. It's like this. The Proverbs are kind of in this spirit. Son, daughter, I've been around a while. This is the way life works. You know anybody who cannot ever accept correction? They're going to make a mess of their lives. It's really people sitting around the campfire talking about life, how life works. So I think that the Proverbs function, they're not Christ-centered, I mean, it's Old Testament, but they function just as well today about how life works. Like in Proverbs 10:12, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all offenses. You know, that's true. Basically, the way you're supposed to respond to a proverb is to nod your head and say, you know, that's right. That's true. Then you make the next lesson, next step. I guess that means I better live that way. Okay. Proverbs also has specific exhortations, things you're supposed to do or not do. I tend to think more about the observations, though. The wisdom and poetry literature includes the Psalms, which, if any book is recognized as having continuity with the New Testament, it's the Psalms. We still use the Psalms. Song of Solomon is helpful in having a healthy biblical appreciation of sexuality and marriage. Ecclesiastes has a bit of this and a bit of that in it. It's such a fascinating book. There is an awareness over to the New Testament side that Jesus offered some wisdom-type teachings. Like, can you think of it a place in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, just look at how this works. Look at how this works out in the world and draw the proper lesson. Like, look how the Father takes care of even the birds of the air. Look at the lilies of the field that neither toil nor spin. But Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed as one of these. Therefore, what? Do not worry about what you shall eat, and what you shall drink, and what you shall wear. Jesus had a bit of the wisdom teacher in him. So I would say that a stronger theme for Jesus is where I'm going to move next, and that is the prophetic side. The prophets are often neglected in our churches, and they need to not be. The prophets running from Isaiah all the way to Malachi are a powerful and important part of the canon and full of moral exhortations. The way I think about them is this. They had a characteristic pattern of argument. And actually, we talk about the way the prophets argued in a book that you should buy, Kingdom Ethics. Gushy. Stephen. Fine. There you go. That's what I'm talking about. All right. Not to mix commerce here. But anyway, it's Saturday. Buy the book today, not tomorrow. Okay. Anyway. The prophets had a particular way of teaching, which went something like this. God is in covenant relationship with you. You are in covenant relationship with God. You promised to be his faithful people. Here's what those promises look like. Keep these promises. Be faithful to God's covenant, or you will face doom and judgment. We think of the prophets page after page, you're about to be destroyed, you're about to be destroyed. But it's really rooted in a covenant theme. And the prophets also emphasize the weightier matters of the law, love and justice. The prophets, more than any other part of the Bible, emphasize the poor, justice to the least of these. You sell the poor for a pair of shoes, you know? Themes in Amos and Micah, Isaiah and Jeremiah, and we don't have time to go into them in detail. The prophets are much more interested in how we treat each other than what we say about God. You know, put away your sacred assemblies. I don't care about them. Give me love and justice and faithfulness. So I see a great deal of continuity. In fact, in this book, we emphasize Jesus clearly taught in the tradition of the prophets. And that's one reason why he was such a threat, because prophets are always the ones who speak the truth to those who don't want to hear it. And we also show in the book that when the prophets talked about justice in the Old Testament, they meant four specific things, and this will preach. This is important. One is economic justice means people have enough to eat. Justice in the area of power means people have a voice and are not just stepped on and dominated. Justice in the area of community means that people are included in community rather than being excluded or outcast. And justice in the area of violence means that people are secure from being physically violated or killed. So, economic life, community life, power, and violence. And look at some of the things that Jesus taught. In economic life, he taught to the poor, he taught on behalf of the poor, and he fed the poor. In violence, he said, blessed are the peacemakers, and turn the other cheek. What he taught about community was, well, as much as anything, by how he lived, including Gentiles and tax collectors and sinners and prostitutes in community with him. And what he said about power was the Gentiles lord it over you, but what you're supposed to do is serve. And he exemplified that in his own life. All right, time is drawing short, but let me wrap it up in this way. I see more continuity than discontinuity between the Old and New Testament. That's what I wanted you to see. Now, I told you I was biased, but I think it's there in the Scripture. There are some points of discontinuity, but the continuity is greater. Okay? The primary discontinuity is that the church of the New Testament is not the same thing as the theocracy of the Old Testament. And so that has a different impact in how we interpret the teachings. But I would wrap up by saying, Jesus Christ himself brings together all these genres and brings together Old and New Testament. Jesus Christ is the center of the biblical narrative. He offered moral teaching in terms of laws and practices. He had a bit of the wisdom teaching dimension, and he definitely was in the tradition of the prophets. As we have always said, that the pinnacle of Scripture is Jesus, and when it comes to the moral teaching of the Bible, that is also true. And so, maybe a takeaway would be, look for ways to get more concrete about what it actually means to follow Jesus. It may mean being more serious about Sabbath. It may mean being more serious about taking care of the poor, or about doing justice, or about other things. Our law versus grace dichotomy has left us kind of lazy, kind of sloppy. We do not work hard at these things in order so that Jesus will save us. We have been saved by grace. But we do work hard at these things because Jesus commands us to be serious about our discipleship. There's no area of life that is exempt from that. How we spend our money, what we do with our time, how we treat other people. And of course, the law of love is inexhaustible. You're never done. You can never say, oh, I've loved all there is to love, I've done. As soon as you do that, you're in the land of lying to yourself, right? So it's a great God that we serve. The Bible is so full of resources for us. And the Old Testament needs to be rehabilitated, brought out of the closet or out of the attic, you might say, and put back as a source of insight for us. So let me close this in prayer. Lord, I do pray that we'd think rightly about this area, and mainly that we'd live rightly, we'd be serious about following you. Help us think about such areas as Sabbath and tithing and money lending and all these things. Thank you that you've given us so much guidance about forgiveness, about reconciliation, about peacemaking, about fasting, and about so many, many other areas. We want to serve you, Lord. Thank you for those who've given their Saturday to this cause. And bless them as they follow you and as they lead churches all over this region. In Jesus' name.